We are. So last time, what we talked about was the connection between ritual or routine and where your heart's at. Because those are often because of, honestly, how we read the New Testament. The things we think that Jesus is against, we kind of think that Jesus is about heart connect and relationship, and the bad guys in the story, who are always the Pharisees, which don't get me started, but the Pharisees, they're the ones who only care about ritual. They just care about routine and outward acts, and Jesus cares about inward righteousness. And so, and of course, there's elements of that in several stories. But the point is that those are not, that's not a dichotomy that is right. That dichotomy that there's either working outward things or there's having an inner life of relationship. You know what I mean? That's not how it works. And so here's a little recap from last time. So there is actually a close connection by design, not just randomly, between heart and emotions and ritual or routine. God designed it that way. And it wasn't that, like Anna and Simeon, for example, in the New Testament. You get the book of Luke around the birth of Jesus, Anna and Simeon, they don't come out of nowhere. What were they doing for decades before they met this little baby, the Messiah of Israel? They were in the temple, ritual, routine, daily. And so what's emphasized is Simeon was righteous. In the Hebrew culture, tzaddik means that he was a righteous man. He was devoted to keeping the law. Then he was righteous and devout, meant he was a deep man of prayer. Righteous and devout, and he was waiting for the consolation of Israel. This is the only thing we know about Simeon. He was righteous and devout and waiting for the consolation of Israel. And he lived basically a devout life of prayer in the temple, which we ought to, that shouldn't be surprising, because the apostles did that after Pentecost, and they moved the movement from Galilee down to Jerusalem. And what did they do every day in Acts 3? It says, and so just as their routine was, daily they went to the temple to go pray. So they go to the temple, and that was the day that they happened to heal a man there. But because that's what they knew. So the point is that the regular practice, both positive and negative, of something that you do affects what your heart feels about it, or what your heart feels about things. There's a story from an old rabbinic story. I think I said last time it was from the Talmud. It's not from the Talmud. It's from the period just after the Talmud. But Rav Huna, means rabbi, and Rabbi Jeremiah said in the name of Rabbi Hiya, they said this. This is something that apparently Rabbi Hiya Baraba said. They abandoned me. This is Jeremiah 16:11. They abandoned me and they did not keep the Torah. Right? And we kind of read that as one thing. They abandoned me and they did not keep the Torah. But the rabbi says, well, he goes, if only they had kept the Torah. Like, that's okay. That's a weird statement. But listen to the explanation. He goes, would that they had abandoned me and yet kept the Torah. For if they had only abandoned me and yet still kept the Torah, the starter dough that is in the Torah would have brought them back to me. The starter dough, they call it. Yeah, the yeast. Yeah. And so the idea was, even if their hearts had turned away, if they would have kept living in a way that was right, their hearts would have eventually turned back, was what he was suggesting. It's like, oh, that actually makes sense, because that does happen. A couple of positive examples that stand out to me. So Psalm 1, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor walk in the, you know, those things. But then there's another man, but blessed is the man whose delight is in the law of the Lord, which means he actually has, like, his heart loves the Lord's instruction. But why would that be given as some sort of something to reach for if kind of the prevalent idea in Western culture is that your heart is just set and you either obey your heart or don't obey your heart? But I don't think that's true. Your heart is not just set. You might have certain affinities for things here and there that last your whole lifetime, but the affections of your heart are not settled. Isaiah 11 talks about a shoot will come forth from the root of Jesse, right? Jesse is David's dad. Isaiah 11, he'll come forth and he will, and the spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the spirit of counsel and might and wisdom. And then it says, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. That's what his joy will be. So speaking obviously about the Messiah, and then it talks about, and when he comes, he will rule and he'll bring peace from sea to sea. So this is Isaiah 11. But one of the descriptions of the Messiah is that he will actually love the fear of God. Like, that's what he'll long for. He'll enjoy the fear of the Lord. And so here's a couple of examples of it's presenting somebody who's mature in the gospel, mature in the Lord, and their affections are actually fully engaged in the things that God cares about, like the fear of God, God's instruction. And so this is what we kind of covered in the I'm giving an overview from last time, is that emotions aren't bad, right? You just got to know how to handle them. Like, they're just bad leaders. It's a silly illustration, but it still comes to mind as kind of appropriate. You know, we have one driver, we're about to have another driver. And like your emotions, your heart is a little bit like a car, right? It can be extremely helpful, especially during dark seasons, right? If everything on the outside is going dark, if the heart has been aligned correctly, like the testimony we have from Gene, then it'll sustain you through the dark season, right? Because the work of the Spirit that is actually residing there and actually has taken root actually sustains you through that. And like Mary's testimony about her was, she's like, she was so full of joy. She wasn't full of, well, I'm just going to grit my teeth and make it through this. And I think that is a great picture of a vision that we want to have for a dark season. I want to have a heart that can be full of joy during that season, right? And so the idea is, I'm not going to tell Uriah, who's at home. Oh, he's listening. Who's at home? He got a knee injury. He's at home listening. I'm not going to tell him when it's time for him to start driving. Listen, the car pretty much is set. So all you got to do is turn the gas on and wherever it wants to go, we'll see where it takes you. Or you just got to walk, right? No, you can learn. You just take some skill, and it takes some patience to learn how to navigate it, right? Just take some patience and some consistency, right? And then you can learn how to navigate it well. Okay, so another way to think of emotions are kind of like, this is kind of the way it made sense to me since I was a teenager. Emotions are kind of just like an outward, when the inner life tries to express itself on the outside, right? Because otherwise the inner life is unknown. You don't know what's in there. You know, the funny example is when you're single. You don't know what's in there. Blissfully ignorant about what's inside. And then you get married and you actually there's only one piece of pie.
Even better when you're married to me.
There's only one piece of pie in the fridge. And you find out, oh my gosh, I want me to have that piece of pie so badly. And then you go, she must have made me that way. It's not the case, right? That was there. You just didn't know. And then God gives you kids. Right? Yeah. So, yeah. So you divide it. That's on a good day. You divide it up. So, and what's that?
You have half enough pizza.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I told Bill, sorry, Uriah, you're an example for everything. But when we had our second kid, I started crying one day. He's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, I never knew I was an angry person. Like, I didn't think I had anger ever. I never was angry as a child. Like, and now I'm realizing I have so much anger. And it's not because of Uriah. It's right, son. It was like somehow having two kids instead of one. It just was like the tipping point. And I realized all this stuff I didn't know. I was like, God have mercy. I'm like, what is it? Backsliding the things I didn't do before because I like hit my limit of where.
And you know, and it's not that the goal is to make sure you find out everything that's wrong inside either, because that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is trusting those things to God, right? And then as God brings them up, you deal with them appropriately. But that's not the focus today. The focus today is how do you even in what would you do if someone intended to aim their life towards that final season of their life? Let's imagine communist China or Islamic Iran or something like this, imprisoned for Jesus' sake. Or even worse. This is so those scenarios are kind of imaginary, because people imagine that there's never that your will's not involved. And so people are so quick to make the jump. Christians are so quick to make the jump. Well, yeah, I had to have that pie last night, but when it comes down to it, and I have the choice to deny Jesus, oh, I ain't denying Jesus. I'm for sure giving my life for the gospel. No, you're not. That's not how it works. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that I live for me now and then suddenly I'll not live for me. It's not how life is. So what we want to talk about is, so what, when I ended last time, I said, today we just talked about some practicals. I want to talk about some practical ways you kind of aim your life at, like, because I want to have a heart that delights in the fear of the Lord and that delights in the instructions of God. I, like, for years I prayed from Proverbs 3 or from Hebrews 12. I want to love the discipline of God. Like, when God has to discipline me to make me mature, I want to love that painful process, because I want to be able to discern, like the author of Hebrews said, it's just your father. He's treating you like a son. It's okay. So the problem is that if you don't learn to accept discipline from your father, then you're just going to end up being an illegitimate child. Learn. And so for years, I mean, since I was probably 20, this was like one of the top things on my list. Lord, teach me to love your discipline. Teach me to love those things that you're trying to, you know, that process of pruning, because it's painful. And generally I hate it, but I want to love it. Because it always bothered me when preachers would get up and talk about how, yeah, the discipline, like when God prunes you and puts you through those hard times, well, that's just something you got to put up with. Well, that's just God, you know, you just got to let him do his thing. And then as though, like, that's, you can totally disconnect from being on God's side during those moments, because of course we're all going to be selfish and all we have vision for is loving comfort. It's like, I don't want to be like that. I mean, even if that's true, I don't want that to be my mission. I don't want that to be the way I'm aiming my life. I want to actually totally value when God's doing those things. So what we're going to talk about is just a few practical things. Again, super interactive. Ask questions, whatever you need. Just raise your hand. And we're going to talk about some practical. Some of these are no does, and some of them you may not have thought about before. But how you shift the heart towards actually loving, like delighting. Like that's usually because, so you know, in the Bible, the word love is generally a word that means loyalty. It's more of an action. It's true. The word is more of an action because like even like Carice quoted that passage from Exodus 34, you're full of steadfast love and loyalty. The word steadfast love there, the word chesed in Hebrew, means somebody who's loyal to a contract or an agreement. Someone who's steadfastly committed to a contract or to like a covenant. And so in that context, of course, he's talking about the covenant that he just made with them in Exodus 20 at Sinai. But generally when the Bible, especially in Hebrew Bible, when they're going to talk about like feeling love for something, what they talk, they use the word that's translated usually delight, at least in the NASB. But generally it's delight. And so, again, emotions are a bad leader, but they're a great tool. If you can learn how to kind of steer the direction of your emotions over time, then they can help sustain you through really dark times. You're still never going to get to the point where you just rely on your heart all the time. But it's a heck of a lot different waking up in the morning and going, looking at my calendar and going, prayer time again. Right? And waking up going, oh God, I can't wait. Oh, just 5 more minutes. I can't wait till I get to pour my heart out in prayer and worship. I can't wait. That's a really different experience, right? And so consistency in following the Lord and just doing some of the things we're going to talk about today leads to more days like the latter description that I just made and less like the former. The former may be normal, but you can have a lot more of the other ones if you just develop some consistency. And just so what often happens is, when we're trying to develop consistency, we find we have a week or two where you're like, oh, I'm just praying just to pray. I don't even feel the Lord's presence at all. And so we quit because that's just routine. That's just empty. I want to be about relationship. What you mean is I don't like to do things I don't feel like doing. But give it some time. Give it some time. I remember Mike Bickle. I love one thing he used to say years ago. Years ago, Mike, he would tell in the real early days of IHOP, because that was around way back in the old days. And he would say sometimes other pastors would come and go. they would go, you know, I really listened to you talking about like prayer and fasting the way you do. I said, you just sound so prideful because you're talking about how you're so committed to living a life of prayer and fasting. And he would just tell him, he goes, of course I am. Why do you think I pray and fast? Like, what? I don't understand. What are you saying? You're saying, and then he would say, and then he would explain that he had, oh, the second part I was going to get to. This other thing that he said that I used to love and it just left my brain. But the point was, is that this is why he was doing it, is knowing that these things were true. And so these same pastors would go, and I just don't agree with what you're saying. And he'd go, well, that's fine. I may be wrong. And he'd go, I'll tell you what, let's do this together. Let's make an agreement, and we will pray and fast regularly, like weekly. We'll be in fasting together, and we'll pray and we'll study the scriptures together. in prayer and fasting, really diligently seeking the Lord, and then we'll find out what the Lord's heart really is on the matter. How about that? And he'd go, how about let's just dive in 6 months to a year, and then some of them he would say 5 to 10 years. Let's dive in. If it's an important matter, let's commit ourselves to prayer and fasting over this for a number of years, and then we'll find out the Lord's heart, not just because I feel like it right now. I go, yeah, let's do that. Let's do that and like commit ourselves to really, you know, finding the Lord's heart in a way that's beyond just what I feel like right now. Well, I don't feel that, doesn't sound right to me. Like, okay, well, let's, you know, develop a little bit of a history of prayer and seeking the Lord and then find out what feels right. Okay. So number one, so is everybody kind of understand where we're going as we're talking? So not a lot of passages today. In fact, we might not have any passages. I might bring some up in a minute, but mostly just talking about practicals, and I might give some examples because a lot of these are from the Sermon on the Mount. So,
I have this question.
Yeah.
I actually don't know where we're going.
No clue. Okay.
I'm listening.
Yeah.
I understand prayer. I understand fasting.
Yeah.
And asking the Lord for just like giving that for a habit.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. So,
is there another angle?
Yeah. So there's two angles. Like, so the first one would be, like, for example, praying. Let me just say this. So the angle would be that we're going to talk about today is the angle of learning how to have a devotional life or just a life in general that is conducive to your heart actually being sensitive and moved with the things that move God's heart, the things that matter to him. And because what I tried to bring up last time and what I'm trying to kind of get more practical with this time is that if we are, like, let's say the election cycle, everything that just happened in the election, everything, if on whatever side you happen to be on, if you were like really shaken and freaked out by the election cycle, like, then I'm trying to say, I don't think you have to be that shaken and freaked out next to like election cycle, even if it goes worse than this one. And so I'm trying to say, I think that the picture that like the Psalms present us or like the life of Jesus presents us is that we can actually have a heart that's a lot more steadfast in loving God, a heart that's more steadfast and unshakable through circumstances, through learning how to, you can almost say how to mature or direct your emotions through routine or practice, things like that. So, I mean, you could look at it in the you know, the flip side of it could be like my sons love sports. It's great. I love sports growing up big time. And so, but I'm constantly trying to work with them going here. So here's what you want to do. You want to learn how to really appreciate sports, but sports nowadays are so consuming. There's like, you can 24/7 be submersed in something about sports. And I go, and so I've told my older kids. And so I go, okay, I want you to watch, be diligent. Now, so you're going to spend all day long diving into sports. So you're going to be playing sports, watching sports, reading sports headlines, thinking about sports. Watch tomorrow morning. Do you have a heart that really is excited about prayer and that really loves the Lord and really wants to obey no matter how costly it is? Or do you have a heart that's really kind of dumbed down and indifferent to those things? And they would go, oh, it totally is. The next day, like, I feel totally indifferent. I could like follow Jesus or follow whatever. It doesn't really matter. I go, so that's the thing. It's basically learning how to use the opposite to steer the heart positively so that the heart can be something, so that your emotions can be something that can be used to strengthen your life in God versus you're always having to swim upstream against your heart so that you can have a life in God. Make sense? Okay. So here are the practicals. So first, obviously, prayer. So now prayer means different things to different people. I would recommend we have two different series on prayer that you guys could go through. One of them's short, one of them's longer. One of them's like a series of like, it's like 5 or 7, you know, like 5 minute videos. And they're just videos, and it's basically just the basics of prayer. The other is like a, like an 8 week series we did. It's like 1 hour audio sessions on prayer. And one of the things I think that, sometimes Christians have a disconnect with, or that we forget, is that everybody in the Bible, everybody, all the Gentiles included, at least all the Gentiles that are talked about, would have learned how to pray from the Jews. You know, so sometimes we forget every single, now we can imagine there are some that were not, but there's not one record of a Gentile that came to the Lord in the book of Acts or after that didn't hear the gospel because they were already hanging out in the Jewish synagogue. So when Paul would go share the, when Paul would go to the nations, to the Gentiles, right? Where did he go? He went to the diaspora outside of Israel, but he went to the synagogue. And that's where there were, this was a normal trend in the ancient world, is that there were lots of pagans who were like, these stories, because they would read the Torah and the rabbis would kind of expound on the stories. These Gentiles were like, these are crazy. We've never heard stories like the Exodus. We've never heard anything like that. You know, our God's not like this God. You know, we have like 30 gods and none of them can do things like this. And so they would come every Shabbat, every Sabbath, and they would be listening to the stories. And so when Paul would talk to these Gentiles about prayer, where had they, because the synagogue served two functions. They would study the law and the prophets, number one, and they would pray together. This is where Gentiles learned how to interact with the God of Israel, was in the synagogue. We have also examples like what have come to be known as the apostolic prayers. Right. If you've hung around IHOP at all, the apostolic prayers are really big over there. Ephesians 1 is like the most well-known pray. Since I heard of it, we haven't ceased me making mention of you in our prayers that God of glory would fill you with wisdom and revelation and the knowledge of his son and on and so forth. And as Gentiles, we have a disconnect. That's actually a Jewish prayer that was around before the time of Jesus and Paul. And he's just saying this thing that we normally just pray for the nation of Israel and for ourselves. I've been praying for you Gentiles. That's the only difference. So that's where they learned how to pray. And so that's all these little series are, is just going, hey, let's learn about what the Jews were praying at the time. And then you'll find like the Lord's Prayer. Oh, that's a neat Christian innovation. No, it's not. It's literally a summary of the most famous Jewish prayer of all time called the Amidah. It's just a summary. All the different points, you know how it quickly jumps from like, your kingdom come, your will be done, you know, let your kid, you know, all these things. It's like, why the bullet points? Because that was just a summary of the other prayer. So,
Jesus had to break it down. Although,
yeah.
Jesus showed
him,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, but they were already praying the other prayer regularly. He just gave them an additional summary that kind of brought down the meatier parts of the prayer. Yeah.
What was the other prayer?
It's called the Amidah.
What is it?
What's the Amidah?
What's it say?
Oh, what's it say? Okay. So it's called the Amidah or the Shmoneh Esrei in Hebrew. And that means the 18 blessings or the 18 benedictions. And so it's divided up into three kind of just praises of God. And then it's got three personal petitions, and then it has the rest of them. So that's six. The other 12 are just their prayers for God to do all that he promised in the covenant.
Would that be like, you know, the Bible? Like, could I read it?
It's not in the Bible, but it was around from before the time of Jesus. Jesus grew up praying it.
Okay.
Paul grew up praying it. And so
Do you still use it today?
Do I? Oh, absolutely. Twice a day.
Why isn't it in the Old Testament?
Because it was developed after that time. Yeah.
Okay.
So in the prayer series, like the 8-part prayer series, I actually have a whole session on the Amidah. And just because it's now it feels awkward because we're not used to
send out the link to that.
Yeah, I'll send out the link. I'll send out a link so everybody has it.
So important.
Yeah. Right.
Not Bible,
right.
Why would you leave that out?
Well, yeah, because it just wasn't. Number one, it was developed after the time of the Old Testament, and number two, that's just not. I mean, think of who they were writing the New Testament to. Like, they weren't actually writing it to me.
Right, Jews.
Yeah, I mean, most of the people already knew it, whether they were Jews or Gentiles. Most of the Gentiles already knew it, and so you know, when you just reference something quickly, like the Lord's Prayer, praying Your kingdom come, mm-hmm. and things like that. Then everybody goes, oh, it's Amidah. You know, that's what we're praying about.
There's probably hundreds of thousands of things in our civilization.
Yes.
But we don't even need to, you know.
Right.
Reference, everybody knows what it is.
Exactly. Yeah. My friend John Harrigan says it's like a bunch of mechanics sitting around a room. If they're talking about something that needs to happen to the car, nobody needs to go, let me tell you what a carburetor is. Okay. Because they all know. They're all mechanics, right?
But I don't know that.
Right, because we're not mechanics.
Yeah.
Like
Google.
Yeah, Google, that's right.
What is a Tesla?
So I'll send out this link, but what I love about the Amidah, and I personally, it's just me, I pray kind of a modified version of the Amidah daily. And what it introduced to me was the really odd, and it felt awkward to me, and now I can't go back. The odd dynamic of praying for God to bring the redemption, for God to raise the dead, for God to establish his kingdom, for God to send the Messiah to reign on Mount Zion. Because, you know, I always think of like, Lord, please, we have this need. Please give us the money so we can pay this bill. So I pray and there's answer. And that's the function of prayer. But what I found out through a lot of study and just prayer myself is that prayer serves another function. It serves the function of anchoring your heart to something. You know, I guarantee you live a life of prayer, praying for a Bentley every day. Or praying for God's kingdom to come, to cleanse the earth from wickedness and to reward the righteous on the last day, your heart is going to be radically different places in a year, right? Because prayer has a way of anchoring your heart to something, because your mouth anchors your heart to something. Like James 3 was what we talked about last time. James 3 said, your tongue is like the rudder of a ship. Your tongue has the ability to set the course of your life either on fire or the other way. And I, you know, Word of Faith kind of took that into like the positive confession route. Okay. The positive confession route, we just name it and claim it. We're always going to talk positive, but that's not what he's talking about. In a Jewish context, that's not what anybody would have thought. So we got prayer, I think, is the number one thing. It's the number one thing that's going to anchor the heart. And so, again, we have those resources to dive more in depth in prayer. But number two, and don't minimize this, the impact of forgiving your enemies, forgiving people that hurt you. A great example in the Sermon on the Mount is actually praying for those who hurt you. Actually praying that God would forgive them when they've defrauded you. I'm not talking about like, oh, he hurt my feelings because this happened. I'm talking about someone who stole money, someone who did this and they hurt you and it was illegal. Pray for that guy. Pray for that guy, that God would forgive him, not hold it against him, not harden his heart there, but God would give that guy grace to repent for what he's done. Not so you get your stuff back, but actually so that, because what did he say right after that? Jesus said, pray for your enemies so that you might be sons of your Father in heaven. Because that's the way he is. That's the way he treats his enemies. He really is concerned that those who have done blasphemous and offensive things to him have an on-ramp to get back into relationship with him. He doesn't want their lives to be ruined.
So you think the hot coals is because it'll turn their heart back to the Lord?
Yeah, yeah. Like, and when I try to picture what how God thinks about it, number one, I try to think about the thing it says in the very last passage of chapter 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. Says, because right after that, it says, because your Father causes the sun to shine on the righteous and the wicked, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust. That's like, American Christians are always acting like they gotta have everything just right for God to provide for their needs. Hitler died pretty comfortable. You don't have to get everything in order for God to provide for you. Like, God is pretty kind and generous. That's not why we try to make things right with God, so that God will provide for us. So God is kind to really, really undeserving people. So if you want to be like your Father, pray and forgive, because that's the way he is.
It changes your heart too.
Big time, right?
Yeah.
Totally does.
I
want
to do it. Let's pray. And then like your heart just changes. Like,
yep. Yeah. Totally does.
I think it's definitely not one of the biggest parts.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, for sure.
It's hard to pray for your enemy and then stay like angry.
Now, definitely you want to learn how to not always be paralyzed by somebody hurting your feelings. Definitely. But I think we're talking even more about like injustice, like something unjust happening, right? And learning, like having a vision to actually like be able to be like Jesus, who endured incredible injustice, but he was able to endure it because the cross, the cross represents like salvation, everything like that now, but you know what? The cross represented for his disciples was injustice. It's not right. He died like a criminal. Like they had to make up lies about him to even get him on trial. And then Pilate says, go ahead. Let me hear your defense. I know you got one. He says, I got nothing. He goes, you're not even going to talk to me? Not going to talk.
I heard a pastor say one time, this one is such a big movement of social justice. He wasn't saying anything bad about it.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you want justice.
Yeah.
That was his.
That's exactly right.
He wasn't talking bad about like social justice.
Right, yeah.
But he was just saying there's such a push for everything to clear here. Because I don't think you want social. I don't think you want justice.
Yeah.
If you want it, I don't think.
That's good.
Because with justice for yourself, we wouldn't deserve anything to ourselves.
We would get justice.
That's what I'm saying.
That's what he's saying. Like, if you want justice,
we have judgment against us.
You don't want God's justice today.
No.
So God's judgment. Death.
Yeah.
And it's quick. Eternal.
Ananias and Sapphira.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's intense. So one of the things, so when it comes to forgiveness, one of the practical things I'd love to leave you guys with is the actual practice of praying for your enemies. The actual practice of praying that God would forgive them and do well for them, to guide them and to lead them to everlasting life. And if it has to start with you being in a bad mood and somebody just looks at you funny, and that is your version of an enemy, then pray for them. But you don't want it to stay there. You want it to grow, right? You want to be able to have a vision to endure. Like you want to have a vision like Jim Elliot or Elizabeth Elliot, like Elizabeth Elliot's story where these natives had just killed her husband and all of their, you know, all of the entire missions team that were there to share the gospel with them. They killed them all in cold blood. Then Elizabeth Elliot goes there with all the wives and says, "We forgive you and we've been praying for you. And we still want to share what you didn't let our husband share." And the entire village came to the Lord. It's unbelievable. Actually, no, it's not unbelievable. It's absolutely believable. But it's remarkable and incredibly uncommon.
Her husband had to die.
Yeah. And it was murder. And she said, "I forgive you. I've been praying for you." And
it wasn't just that generational
murder. Yeah. Yeah.
I had to kill.
Yeah.
Kill.
And
other times, retaliate.
Yeah. And up until the present time, that was 60 years ago, to the present time, the entire tribe is serving the Lord. Credible testimony. So one of the things I'd like to do practically is give you guys a vision for praying for your enemies. And I know what it's like to sit there and, if you're not committed to just like, I'm going to pray. What happens? All the arguments, either the ones you're going to tell them when you tell them off, or the ones you're just going to sit there and justify how angry you are. Just flood your head. Oh my God. So just shut it down. Pray for them. So you can be like your Father in heaven. Learn it. Next thing. So prayer. Forgiveness, take forgiveness seriously. Next thing is getting grounded in the narrative of the Bible. The Bible isn't, I don't want to say it this emphatically, but it was at least a big disservice when chapters and verses were added to the Bible. Because it made us think the Bible is something that it's not. The Bible is telling stories that fit a grand narrative. The Bible is not telling verses. So,
is there somewhere you can actually read it?
They actually sell Bibles that don't have chapter or verse. They're just only individual books. Even the word Bible comes from a Latin word, biblos. Biblos doesn't mean book. It means library. The Bible isn't a book at all. The Bible is a library. It's a collection of many books. Yeah. Yeah. So finding a plan that you stick to is really helpful. And if you, like my family this year, we're reading through the Torah together and reading through the first 5 books of the Bible together in a year. So it's slow. It basically breaks down to about a chapter a day, and all of our family's going through it. And so in our devotion times, we sit down and we say, okay, what stood out to you guys in the Torah reading this week? And they'll go, oh man, you know, when God rescued them out of Egypt, that was crazy. And so we just talk about little details, and then everybody understands on their individual level. But what's important is not that they remember this verse or that verse, but what they're doing is getting grounded in a narrative and learning how to understand the world because of that story. Because that story is really a lot more reliable for understanding what's going on in the world than the news is. Yeah.
Torah different than the first books in my Bible?
No, Torah is just what it's called in Hebrew.
Okay, so it's not like
yeah. In my regular Bible. No, same. Literally just the first 5 books. Yeah, the Torah is just what it's called in Hebrew.
Maybe 2 Bibles.
Right. Right, it's a good point. The Jewish Bible has, they have 3 divisions. They call it the Torah, the Nevi'im or the prophets, and the writings. They call it the Tanakh. So that's why I just said the Torah. But okay, so getting grounded in the narrative. And if you, so some people are reading through the Bible in a year. We're just reading through the Torah in a year. Another one that's really good that I really like is, if you've never done this, you should try it. Everybody should try it. If you don't have anything else, read a psalm a day. Psalm a day is basically a 5-month plan to get through the Psalms. And then you just start all over. So what I did, I started all over again in January. And so what is today?
Oh, 31st.
So today I don't read a psalm. But you could basically go 1 through 30, and then you start in 1 again. And if it has 31, I just skip that day. I keep it in the Psalms. So I'll go Psalm 1 on the 1st, Psalm 2 on the 2nd. Then I'll go, and then on the 30th, I'll read Psalm 30. And then on the 1st of next month, I'll read Psalm 31, then 32, and then 33. So if you do that, every 5 months, you'll make it through the Psalms.
Or like I've done. Psalms is very emotional. It'll come to every subject you can imagine.
Yes.
All I do, like today was the 31st, I did 31, and I add 36 to 1, and I add 39.
Oh.
And then I go up until there's no more. There's about 4 chapters then.
Wow.
I'm done in a month.
Yeah.
Songs. So I go through.
That's a good idea, too.
And that's before I go on.
Yeah.
Whatever else.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, same with
it
me.
Just always brings me back to the Lord. And
me too.
Who he is,
me too.
And what he's done, you know, so many times.
Yeah.
He meets me right now today.
Me too. I go through like different seasons, but every time I leave the psalm, at least one psalm a day, I always regret it. So I always come back. Every time I go, you know, I think I'm going to maybe do this instead of that, I always end up going back to the psalms in addition to something else. That's good. That's a great way to do it too.
Start memorizing too, just because.
Yeah, totally. I like that as well. Last two, and we'll do these quick. Last two. Fasting. Fasting is, I don't think talked about in that. Fasting is was a thing in Jewish culture as well. So fasting is essentially, I actually heard a pastor say one time that he didn't fast anymore because he tried and it didn't work. So that's not how fasting works. So
work actually. So
fasting is specifically, people hate fasting because it makes you feel really weak.
It makes you hungry.
Yeah, it makes you feel it really weak in a number of ways. It when you fast, you feel weak in your body, and it feels but you also, your defenses are down a little bit. And so you feel a little bit weak to control the rawr inside. And so people don't like it. And so you're like, well, I always feel so rah when I'm fasting. But fasting, consistent fasting over time, has probably been the one of the most fruitful things that I have ever done. I've encouraged people to fast weekly that I have kind of met with and discipled for years. And every single person has told me it has completely changed my life to fast regularly. Every single person, not one exception. And it has a way. I actually, one guy told me one time that he'd been fasting regularly, and one week he skipped it. And a little bit later on in the week, his wife looked at him and said, "You didn't fast this week, did you?" Because it had so tenderized him over time. It had made him a lot more tender. And he was a lot less harsh. And so she just knew it. She saw him. She said, "You haven't fasted, have you?" He said, "No, I didn't fast this week." She goes, "I could tell. Your heart wasn't as tender. You were." And so at the beginning, when you start to fast, you're kind of like, rah, 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 rah. But if you develop some consistency, it develops this tenderness, not just towards your spouse, but towards the Lord, that is pretty, pretty helpful.
She looked in the fridge,
the steak was gone. Yeah, it could have been that too. The one piece of pie.
She's like, the pie's, these pies gone. You weren't fasting.
Now, if you want to dive more, so fasting is essentially a way of humbling yourself before God. That's what it is. Fasting is the act of humbling yourself. Because you can sing or you can pray, I humble myself all day long. But fasting, in my experience, is the most practical way of humbling yourself before God. Praying for your enemies is right up there too. But fasting is the most practical way that I know of personally to humble yourself before the Lord. And it's basically just puts you in touch with the fact that you're not only weak and totally incapable of doing everything you rely on God to do, but even if you could, there's so much junk inside that it's a good thing God doesn't trust you with that much power, because you would abuse other people with it. So it's just an act of humility. You just fast and you're like, oh God, I just love and appreciate you so much more right now. And so I use it to kind of be an anchor to turn my heart to start every week, turn my heart to the Lord with some fasting. So if you want more details on fasting, we can just talk to me later. Last one. And this is, I think this is a good regular one, but I kind of sometimes use this as like crisis management too, is giving. Giving has this interesting way of, like, because all of these things, what we're talking about, shifting our hearts, think about like Jesus said, you can't serve two masters. Either you'll love one and hate the other, or you'll serve one and despise the other. So God and mammon cannot serve both of them. To say mammon means money is not quite right, but it's related. And the point of that passage is you cannot have one eye. If you read the larger passage in chapter 6, you can't have one eye set on the things to come and one eye set here. It doesn't work. Eventually, you're going to lock on something. And so what he's encouraging is fasting, prayer, giving, these things, doing them before God alone, because when you do that, it stores up a reward in heaven with God.
Is that, when you say the eye, is that the darkness part of the verse?
Yeah, if your eye is dark, then your whole eye will be, yeah.
It's not actually your eyes on, like.
It's an old Jewish proverb that means like, if your eye is dark, it means like you're basically a selfish person. Having a dark eye or a light eye means selfish or dark. But the point is, and the contrast was having your eye light. If your eye is set on light or brightness, that was a common analogy in the prophets and the Psalms of the age to come. It was the age of light. And so other Jews talk like that. Other Jewish writings mention things like that about the eye. So the point is that you store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, or we say treasures. You can also think of a reward in heaven, because Jesus says, if your reward is there, then that's where your heart will be. See what I'm saying? If your reward is there, it will attach your heart to there. So it says in Revelation, says it in the Psalm, says it in Isaiah. One day the Lord's going to come, and all of the righteous who didn't get, all of the humble, the meek of the earth who didn't get their reward in this age, all of them are going to get it. It's not been lost. It's not been forgotten. Lord's going to bring it. Everything that you were denied here, that you should have had, the Lord will bring it and you will have it. Jesus is saying that these things have the ability to anchor your heart in that day when you get your reward, instead of being so preoccupied with this age. Like, instead, anchor everything in the day when you get your reward there. And one of the primary ways he describes it is giving. So I'm going to end with this, because the natives are getting restless. Is giving has a way of doing that, especially good for me. Is I don't think of myself as exceptionally materialistic. But nonetheless, when I kind of find myself in a funk and I have a hard time getting out of it, like, you know, it's been 6 months since I'd really wanted to pray. And I go, man, this is a funk. This is kind of my crisis management, is I find something that's really precious to me that I really like, and I give it away. It's just kind of like, it's kind of like a, what do you call those things? The defibrillators or something. Like when I just cannot snap out of it, that helps. That helps. And so my take is that especially chapters 5 and 6 in the Sermon on the Mount, they give a lot of practicals that are very helpful for learning how to have your heart fixed on what's to come. Because when you're fixed on what's to come, people can take things from you here. And that's, Jesus didn't just tolerate the injustice that he did because he was such a good guy. Obviously, he knew that his reward was still coming. He didn't think that, like, his life was in jeopardy, and I would never be happy again if I let this injustice slide. He knew, he was full of faith. God is going to reward me richly. I'm going to be raised to eternal life and have my reward. And he was so anchored then in that day when he was going to get his reward that it was easy. And so part of this is just to give a vision, because the daily grind can be tough, and not having an adequate vision for yourself for then can be very hard. What it leads to over time is we end up having visions of just surviving the day. I just need to get through today without doing something terrible. That's not a good long-term thing. If you got to do that for survival's sake, for a minute, do that. But don't do that long-term. You need to learn how to have a vision for the end of your life and you being faithful and totally unshakable in the Lord, because your heart is anchored to something that's eternal. It's unshakable with, no, it doesn't matter if the economy collapses or somebody steals your car. You're unshakable because, so that's what I'm trying to cast, is a vision for that. And over time, if you don't have that, survival mode can lead to you just kind of excusing some of the weak areas of your heart instead of having a vision for the Lord transforming them. And you just kind of settle in, well, that's just the way I am in that area. And I really hope to shake everybody a little bit from that. Well, I have a short temper. Or I just can't tolerate certain things. Or I just struggle a little bit with fear. Don't do that. Don't settle for those things. Don't settle for that as a long-term vision. I'm going to be just as frightened in 30 years as I am now. I'm going to be just afraid of somebody taking this life away from me then than I am now. Don't do that. Know what I mean? This is about trying to anchor yourself in a vision that is long-term so that you don't have to, you know, it's not about making yourself perfect. You're always going to have a limp in this age, but at least don't stop growing. Keep reaching and growing. And these are some of the practicals that I have found are most helpful for me to kind of maintain a vision, to keep growing in the Lord, a vision to have a heart that is actually engaged with loving and serving the Lord.